Hey everyone, welcome back to Huron County Author Talk, a podcast where we speak to many talented local authors about a variety of topics within the world of writing. I'm your host, Hamilton Baker of the Huron County Library, and I'm excited to bring you another episode in Season 2. If you're a writer, a reader, or someone who likes to hear authors talk about their craft, how they publish their books, different marketing strategies they employ, and much more, then this show is for you. In this episode, I sat down with Don Hayward, one of Huron County's local authors. In our interview, Don talks about his most recent releases, Return and Row, two science fiction novels that take place in Goderich in the near future, as well as some of the other books he's written over the years. He talks about the advantages of writing what you know, as well as how to write what you don't. He also tells me how he experiences editing, the value of feedback, how he creates and crafts his plots and endings, the challenges involved with writing sequels, and much more.
How long have you been writing, and what kind of books do you write?
As I was explaining, like, I've written something for my whole life, right? And all verses and stuff when I was younger. My first attempt at serious prose was this awful science fiction in the 1960s, partly because I didn't have spell correct on my portable typewriter, which was really was kind of embarrassing.
Typewriter, right.
Yeah, right. And not only typewriter, but mechanical, not even electric typewriter, which was, but, so anyway, so I've always had that bent, and probably, as I said to somebody, said in my little book, Echo of the Whippoorwill, if I thought I was really going to try serious writing later in life, I might have taken English more seriously than I did. And I enjoyed English, but, you know, I was more thinking of science. Right. So this present era, my first effort, 2007, I decided to try and answer this question of, what would collapse look like locally? And by locally, I was thinking probably our county, Dufferin County, Shelburne, Great Lakes Basin, right? And so I wrote a chapter. I thought I was going to write a short story. I wrote a chapter. I was still working full-time, so I just kind of put it aside for 2 years. And then I picked it up again in 2009 when I had time. Mm-hmm. And I started working with it, rewrote what I had written, and then just started going, and my little short story turned into a novel, which turned into three novels, mm-hmm. right? So, and that would be, I guess you'd call that dystopian literature or something. Everybody thinks of dystopia as Mad Max or some sort of zombie apocalypse or something, right? Mm-hmm. And the really real horror is, what happens if we lose just what we have, and then we got to figure out a way to survive after, right? So that's really the kind of question I was asking myself. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we got through that, and that got I published the first version of that in 2014. So you could say there was 5 years from the time I started taking it seriously to when I actually had something to hold in my hand, and I learned a lot about writing, so I've done a lot of reworking on that too, and now it's a three volume trilogy. Well, got to be a trilogy, right? Mm-hmm. I carried on that theme with two more stories, called The Seventh Path is the next one, and that title actually comes from Ojibwe lore, where everybody's given a quest and you're given 7 erroneous paths to the quest. Uh-huh. But if you don't get back on the right path after the end of the 7th erroneous path, then your quest fails. That's kind of the lore. So the 7th path is, that's what it is. So it's that. And then there's a sequel to that just to finish out the story of where the story started to go. Mm. So, and then I wrote the little murder mystery, Murder on the Godrich Local, as I said, because I wanted to try writing something, maybe had a real plot in it, because I tend to write episodically, like I build a story up in cycles of scenarios that kind of interlock, but create a chain that's going somewhere, hopefully.
Right.
But not a classic, you know, a story rising to the climax and then the denouement. Not a classic Shakespearean plot line, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, so I thought I'd try that. So I had fun writing that. And then I guess still dystopia, but a bit different, is Sherwood Green, which is about eco-terrorism, trying to stop industrialism to save life on the planet. And it's basically eco-terrorists attack Toronto as the financial capital of Canada, which is the vulnerability of Canada. It's all the money is the vulnerability, not any particular bit of infrastructure or anything else, even though that comes into it. So I did that. And as I was telling you, the beta reader says I write a lot of genres, so I don't focus, right? Which is, I never thought, maybe I did tell it. I mean, when you have ADD, it's like life is a whole series of new rabbit holes, right? And you get interested in this one, you get interested in that one. So that's kind of the way things go.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got into the idea that I was going to leave a little bit of a memoir to my family, and I decided to hang it on some fiction. So I wrote this book, Echo of the Whippoorwill, which is about my childhood in a little town in Northern Ontario that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
A company town that ended up being torn down in the 1980s. So there was that one. And I did a nonfiction history of High Falls. That's the name of the little town that's no more. Because there was all this material about it and a lot of stuff, a lot of people interested who used to live there. So I pulled all that together, and so it's more of like an annotated pictorial history of High Falls. So, and I keep learning on that. Actually, I got new material. I got to actually revise a manuscript, even though it might never get printed. Mm-hmm. But at least the revised complete manuscript will be available to somebody if they ever want to bother with it. And then my final thing, and maybe this is where I'm going to end up with my writing career at my age, is going to be science fiction again, which is kind of like full circle to what I was tried in the 1960s. And I was inspired by Spielberg, and especially Spielberg's miniseries Taken. And they promised a sequel, they never did. And that was 2002. So by about 2020, I'm saying, well, I haven't seen a sequel. There's never going to be a sequel. So I'm going to write one. So that's when I started writing it, and that's my story, Return. And then Return demanded its own sequel. So now it's got a sequel that's also published, Roe Alien Legacy. And now I got three more books conceived, and one I've already started to draft out of after that to carry on the story. So that's where I am.
Right. Right. So, if I'm not mistaken, you released Return and Roe Alien Legacy in 2023. Is that right? Or was Return in last year?
Return was the first version, edition one, to fancy it up, was early in 2022, about in the spring of 2022.
Okay.
And then Roe Alien Legacy, which is one book. I know it sounds like two, but Alien Legacy is kind of like the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a direct sequel, I just kind of picked that up, and I just now published that. Just trying to think of when I finally got finalized with Ingram. June or July, this summer anyway.
2023.
Yeah, so okay. It's just really been finalized.
Right.
So, and I spent a lot of time since then re-editing stuff that had been published other ways and having them published through Ingram. So I've been spending an awful lot of editing time this year too.
Right.
Right, which I just finished the Sherwood Green Ingram version, I call it, right?
Yeah, right.
Because and that's all editing, and because I learned to write better, because Sherwood Green I wrote in about 2017. And so I've learned to write a little better, I hope. So I had a lot of little tweaking to do.
Right, to fix
so
it.
So throw stuff out and, you know, so that's where I am. But now I'm back trying to finish the third book in the science fiction thread.
So those two are your most recent releases, Return and Row, Alien Legacy, 2022 and 2023, right?
Yeah.
So then they're set in Goderich, right? Like, can you tell us a bit more about that? I mean, it's going to be a trilogy, but right now there's two books out.
Yeah, well, the thing is, okay, I Taken, Spielberg's miniseries Taken promised a sequel. And this is not a spoiler, is that it ends in Texas. But I'm not from Texas.
Right.
And I can't pick up the story in Texas. I can't pick up the story in Seattle, where the one character lived, or anywhere else. So I said, well, of course, I like to write about Canada anyway, and about Ontario, and I like to write where I am, right? So mm-hmm. I'm in Goderich. So how do I get this story to Goderich, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have the father of the little girl in Taken. Can't stand the heat, and he tries to go far as away from everything as he can. So coming to Canada to some backwater town like Goderich, sorry, don't take that as an insult, it's where nobody would know him.
Right.
And so he could just, you know, at least not be harassed or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I got the story into Goderich.
Okay.
And because he's in Goderich, and Return is... This is kind of a spoiler, but anyway, Return is the one character coming back to Earth, returning. It's logical that she will return, where she will come to Goderich. So that gets the story focused on Goderich. So that's how I got it here,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I like, you know, I like putting in the local color and stuff, you know, so stores, allusions to characters in town a little bit. I think, actually, the Bedford is the only real place I actually refer to, I think. That and the post office, of course, the post office is genetic, but mm-hmm. the Bedford is the one place that actually people know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And that's only because I get some of the action happening in the bar in the Bedford, right? So.
Yeah.
We got reporters involved here, so we're going to have a bar involved. We're going to have reporters involved, right?
Yeah. Right, so, yeah.
Anyway, but, you know, just so it's filling a little local color and things that local people will recognize a general thing without it being all described in detail. And people who don't know Goderich will just create their own image of whatever it is here with, you know, with a little bit of kind of sketching out that's in it. And I think that's enough, because I think in writing you're really trying to exploit the reader's imagination, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to give them too much. You want to give them enough to stimulate them and then let them do the thing, right?
Fill in the rest.
So that's that's why it focused on Goderich, and then because, again, you know, the whole write what you know thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of stuff has to do with Canada. I have a lot of stuff about the U.S. and I can't claim direct knowledge of some of it, but you throw in some color. And one of the tricks, of course, of writing is that if you don't know what you're talking about, don't say much about it.
Right.
Right. And I used to say that about my trilogy. I have horses involved and harness horses. And unfortunately, my father could have told you in detail exactly how to harness a horse because he grew up using them. But I have no idea. But so you're going to get a few buzzwords thrown in, like whipple trees and harness and tack and stuff like that. But you avoid trying to describe harnessing a horse because, A, you'll mislead people that don't know any more than you do. And people who know what they're taught, how to harness a horse, will think you're an idiot.
Right, yeah.
Right, so you better try and avoid both.
It's bad both ways.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So when I set scenes in the U.S., it's such a generalized kind of thing that it could be not too far off the mark, you know, mm-hmm. without trying to invent something that just wouldn't be, you know. So in Roe especially, there's some things that happen in the U.S., and Google Maps is a great way to set a place with real street names and stuff like that, and suburbs of towns, and without actually having ever been there.
Right.
But you don't dare go any further than that, you know. If you were there and you actually saw, here's this, like Godrich, there's these things here, there's street benches, there's this store, there's the park that's set up this way, you can do all that, right? But if you don't, mm-hmm. if you haven't been there, you look at a map and you say, well, there is what the layout is, and so you can use the layout and do your story on top of that, and don't get any more detailed. Or detail is so general that general detail, that's a little bit of a joke. Yeah. So I have stuff happen, say, in El Paso, and I have stuff happening in Dallas. And on the highway between Dallas, well, actually, the highway is between El Paso and Dallas, and Dallas and Little Rock, Arkansas. But you just pick points, and then you write a story around that point, and you don't make a big, you make sure that the actual geography and the what's actually there isn't vital to the story so much.
Right.
So you can have a highway overpass, but you don't need to really get it exactly in detail, for instance, right? So mm-hmm. so that kind of thing. But you're more comfortable when you're in Godrich, and you can, you know, as I say, the bench in front of the bank and stuff like that, well, you know it's there. And people mm-hmm. who live here will recognize, oh, that's where that is.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
But it doesn't matter to the story, and it won't matter to anybody who doesn't know Godrich. Mm-hmm. So right. Anyway. I don't know. Did that answer the question? I don't know.
I think so. I just had one more about that, which was, is it set, the two books, are they set in present day? Are they set in the future?
Well, they're in an indefinite future.
Okay.
Okay, so for instance, there's a colony on Mars. Self-driving cars are a reality.
Right.
Although they aren't, electric cars aren't 100%. And there's lots of internal combustion stuff. Actually, internal combustion engine actually plays a plot in the part, of Return.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and it's just it's not that it was required. It was just was added some embellishment, and I have an alien say something about it that would be alien to them, because they're well beyond internal combustion technology.
right. Okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So things like that. So,
okay.
Like what was the rest of that question?
Well, that was it. It takes place
in
the future. It is in the future.
And it goes on in the future, because the problem is you couldn't make the story work in the present day, because you're trying to get people to suspend their disbelief.
Yes.
Well, you can get them to feel grounded in the place, but, and even that the place is somewhat the same in the future, because it's not like some great future where everybody's in flying cars and stuff, or the town has been totally destroyed or modified, right?
Right.
But at the same time, it's a future that you cannot then say, well, that couldn't happen, because it's a future, right? So anything can happen. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Okay, that answered my question. Yeah, that's what.
Yeah.
Check out books written by local authors at the library. Visit our website at HuronCountyLibrary.ca to place a hold today. In the two books, who is your favorite character and why?
Oh, the last two books?
The last two books that you've released, yeah.
Well, I think it becomes quite obvious as you start getting through Return that this little character, Roe, becomes quite a bit of fun. And that's, of course, that's the second book is really where she develops as the main protagonist. Or the, or, but the thing is, there's all shared stories because there's Return especially, the story seems to be first about the adult woman in it.
Mm-hmm.
And her father and whatever's going on around that. But gradually, Ro is involved in more and more action. And then, but at the end of the story, it's not obvious that, you know, Ro wasn't the only, she still might not be the primary character of Return.
Mm-hmm.
But in Ro, Alien Legacy, she really starts to evolve into the main character, and then there's a reversal of the roles ever between her and Ellie, who was would be her mother, right? And so her mother Ellie is kind of still the main character in Return, but Ro then goes from that to gradually becoming the main character, so there's more action around her. And then the end of the story, Ro is all about Ro,
right?
It's just the last chapter is totally, and that's setting the hook for the next stories.
Right.
Although the hook for the third stories is about halfway through Ro.
Okay.
The hook to the story about, now its title is Z-263-A, A Galactic Honeymoon.
Oh, okay.
And that starts out about halfway through Ro.
Ah.
So, but that story wanders off on its own branch, and then those characters aren't directly involved anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Although just for science fiction people, their characters you could call doppelgangers are actually carry on the story for them on Earth.
Because
one thing, if you look at the Taken, there's a couple of things in Taken that you carry on. One is that the aliens can shapeshift. They appear as humans.
Mm-hmm.
And they have ability to interact with minds, their own minds and human minds. So those two basic, you got to accept them. Mm-hmm. Science fiction, after all.
Right.
And I keep trying to explain, in science fiction, the operative word is fiction.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so anyway, so that's it carries on through. And you can have a lot of fun with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, another thing I guess I maybe say here might be interesting is that science fiction as a genre is a pretty gloomy thing. There's some people who write humor, but most writers don't write any humor.
Right.
It's really, and good literature, good drama has humor and good humor has drama. You got to try and work the two in together, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not somebody to consult on how to do that because I'm just a learning writer myself. But
right.
But you got to try and weave the two together. And so I said that one thing I'm going to make sure I have is some humor.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, the Ro character in Return, a lot of her initial contribution is driving the story, but throwing some humor in with her.
Mm-hmm.
And not slapstick comedy, not that kind of stuff, but just lightheartedness, more like, you know, the way things happen.
Like C-3PO in Star Wars.
Sorry, yeah, right, exactly. See, Star Wars is good because they threw humor in. Lots right. of the humor between C-3PO and R2-D2 mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff was really good.
Yeah.
There's another good element to that movie. That movie really actually did quite a few good things.
There was a lot of humor. Han Solo's got humor too, and oh yeah.
There's... Oh yeah, yeah. The joking between Chewbacca and Hans and the whole thing, and it's as counterpoint because it's all serious.
Too
like
much.
If you look at, there was no humor on Night of the Living Dead.
Is that? I think
you haven't seen the original movie.
I don't think I've seen.
It's intense.
There's no humor.
There's no humor, and I don't think there's any humor in any of that genre.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, no.
The movie Alien, I think the one thing it lacked was humor. I can't think of any humorous stuff that ever happened in Alien. It was all death and gore and mystery
and fear.
Heavy stuff, right?
Yeah.
And the heavy stuff is better if it's counterpoint, if there's some counterpoint.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And why, like Star Wars.
That's why Star Wars works
yeah,
so well.
Yeah, because, it, you know, serious, these guys might die in the garbage pile.
Right.
But they're making jokes.
Right. Yeah. And the rebellion might fail, but they're making jokes.
Yeah.
I did have a question, though, about Roe. When you set out to write the first one, Return, did you know Roe was going to become a central character, or did that happen through the first draft?
Well, it just happened as the story grew. Like as right. I say,
it
like,
wasn't planned.
Stories, the way I write is the stories tell themselves to me in the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a rough idea where I'm going. Lots of times, though, I'm not quite sure. And but the story finally makes it plain what's going to happen,
right?
You know, and I got to have to say in Return, I got to the point where I was saying, well, okay, now this part of the story's got to end. So how am I going to end it?
Mm-hmm.
And there's one device called the bookend ending, where the ending reflects the beginning.
Oh yeah.
So. When you read Return, you'll see that. As soon as you get to the end, you'll recognize the reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes then the entry into the sequel, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, the last storyline in Return is the doorbell rang. Well, that's a pretty obvious hook, but anyway, the right. doorbell rang, right?
Right.
And the first story, storyline in Roe is the doorbell rang.
Right.
Yeah. Now, in Roe, there's a little bit of, again, using the device of the reporter, Quants, to try to build a wee bit of grounding of the story so that the reader could pick up Roe and read it and not necessarily not enjoy it because I hadn't read Return.
Right.
That's the kind of the art of the sequel, right? You kind of like to make each story stand alone, but you want to continue the story. And that's like, you know, kind of hard to do, right?
Yeah,
so,
it is, yeah.
But that's a technique like I've used quite a bit, that bridge over thing. Like in the Collapse series, the last words in Collapse are my one character writing in her journal.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening of the next book, which is called Under Shadows, is that passage from her journal. Right?
So it connects it, right. Yeah.
And then they jump almost a year.
Oh, yeah.
But right. still,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
But so that kind of thing. So when ending it, if you know where the story's going, it's great. And when I did the Collapse trilogy under the running title After the Last Day, I got about halfway through the story and I started thinking about, well, what's the end of this story now? Or I got into the third book anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, well, the logical end is that my characters, it spans 60 years, so my characters get old.
Right.
Right? A lot of them die.
Mm-hmm.
Natural causes, most of them. Mm-hmm. The so I got thinking about the end, so I wrote a draft of the ending. The actual ending.
Oh, okay.
And I was still like almost a whole book away from getting there.
Okay, yeah.
Right? And then what happens, you write the rest of the story and then you get to that initial draft and you say, okay, what did I write before that makes this not work properly? And then you got to work on what you're going to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that guides you because you know, well, I can't do this because at the end, this is what's going to happen. But sometimes that helped. But most of what I'm writing, I don't exactly have the ending until the story gets to the point where it's obvious the story's told me where it's got to end, right?
Right.
So that's it. Anyway, I don't know. So Roe grew.
Right.
And then by the end of the book, Roe was obviously, I liked the character, so I wanted to do more with the character.
I guess we'll switch gears a bit. Did you always know you wanted to self-publish?
Well, yeah, any other route didn't seem to be an option. Like if I was young, like your age,
mm-hmm.
I would really seriously look for an agent and a publisher, I think. Although, you get a lot less freedom if you publish standard publishing.
Yep, you do.
Because the thing is, yeah, you might get professional editing, although a lot of professionally produced books are shockingly full of as many errors, as technical errors, as say my books might be. And so the thing is, at least the technical, the copy editors for a professional publisher should actually be 100%, I think, first of all. Secondly, the whole objective of the editors and the publishers is to produce a saleable product. And that for them means something not too long, not too many pages, which really hurts a guy like me. And so they're all the classic, oh, get, you don't need this, take this out of the story, throw that away. And it may be something that, as a writer, you think is really important. So I don't think I had an option. Anyway, my age, like my 2009, so I was, 63 years old. I figured, well, you know, I don't have 20 years to go through the struggle of finally get some publisher to do something and recognize it. And my objective actually is to write and tell a story and get, try to get a lot of people to read it. But being a bestseller, as I told a bookseller once, I'm not trying to be rich and famous. I just like people to read my stories.
Right. You told me, so, you said earlier, if you found a book that had the cover ripped off and somebody...
Yeah, well, that's it. Like you keep seeing these people, oh, big crime, people with dog ears, books, there's a special place in hell for them and stuff. And I keep saying, nothing would make me happier than see my book dog-eared and roughed up and coffee stains on the cover lying around, because then I'd know people read it. And I don't, it's not, the book is, to, you know yourself, because you've held one in your hand, your own little baby, right? It's a precious thing if you're the writer to have that.
It is, yeah.
But it's not like it's a sacred object that, you know, we're going to put in the Lost Ark and going to be preserved as some sort of holy artifact, right?
No, it's not going to the museum.
The story is more important than the physical book.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an archivist, the physical book you want to preserve up there. That's your job, right?
Right.
But other than that, if you're the writer, get it out there.
Yeah.
You know, like I've got a real ambivalence towards copyright. I would be upset if people just took my stories and tried to make money off them without any acknowledgement or sharing. On the other hand, if somebody took one of my stories and just shared it around, I'm not going to get bent out of shape because people are reading it.
Right.
And so to me, that would be, now you wouldn't mind the sales. I mean, you know, always like to have them, but, so, it's just read it, damage it, dog ear it, you know, put the cat in as a bookmark. Who knows?
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, read the thing. So that's all really what I think about. So, but it is nice to hold that book in your hand when you get the first, especially the very, very first one, what you've just got, right?
When my first proof copy came, I don't know if it was 3 or 4 months ago, 5 months ago, it was a while ago, but when that first proof comes, it is pretty special.
It's mine.
You think
you're in the Lord of the Rings there. It's precious. Right. But you got to get over the precious thing.
Yeah, you get over it. You do get over it because you have to. And but that first time it's pretty special.
That's why I tell people, write something, get something published, no matter if it's any good, you'll still get the same thrill.
Right.
I don't know. I don't want to sound arrogant, but when we're really young, we have the drive, but maybe we don't have so much to say. And we aren't really able to say it somehow, right? And so, and lots of times what we think was a good storyline turns out to be not, or whatever. Still might be a good idea. Like those two ideas you had there, you still might be able to realize them now.
Yeah, the ideas.
In a different way, but you got to just say, what was the idea, and then write it, and don't think about what you already wrote.
Right, the original
idea. Don't try to correct what you wrote, especially now whatever, so many years later, right?
Yeah.
Like that first horrible science fiction I wrote, I don't know, the darn one copy of the manuscript followed me around for years, and I just threw it away about 10 or 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just because I wasn't going to try and correct it.
Right.
And what I thought back then, and, well, let's see, 1964, so I guess I was about 18, 19 years old,
mm-hmm.
thinking it was a great idea. Well, thinking back about it, it was a hackneyed idea even then.
Oh, right. So, yeah.
You know, and even though, as I say, I like Hemingway in the style, the other thing Hemingway said that I always take to heart is, you're never going to be original, so try to be good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard that one. Yeah,
yeah. That's and that one, yeah. That really is, I think, for everybody who wants to write, you know, don't worry, oh, I don't have this special story. No, you've got a story you want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's not original, but make it good, i.e. put your spin on it and technically try to make it as good as you can. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so anyway, that's, I always like, I don't know, I'm, you know, you think, I haven't read that many Hemingway, a few, two or three of his stories, but his sayings seem to be, you know, kind of inspiring.
And helpful, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Where do you find inspiration for your books, or is it not even about inspiration for you?
You have to have a story to tell.
Right.
If you have a story in your head, that's the inspiration. So it's like, obviously the science fiction is inspired by, and I actually in the front matter of Return, I say, you know, there's inspiration was Spielberg's Taken plus, you know, Spielberg's other work with Aliens, right?
Right.
So that's the inspiration. And of course, the motivation there was the sequel to Taken. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to tell the story about collapse. As I said, I wanted to write, what would it look like locally if there was a global collapse? So that was the story I wanted to tell. So that was the inspiration. It mm-hmm. was, you should have something you want to say,
right?
Whatever it is. If somebody wanted my advice, I'd say, you know, whatever you want to say is valid.
Mm-hmm.
Write it down. See if you can make it interesting enough that other people can appreciate it.
Right.
And enjoy or find something in reading what you want to say.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah.
I don't look for. And the problem is, of course, so many ideas pop up. As I say, I got a ideas file in my computer that's got maybe a dozen or I don't know how many subfolders of ideas that I'll never write.
Right.
So I think if somebody's creative, somehow they're going to come up with their own inspirations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it might get so angry about something going on, you got to write a story about it.
Right.
Or you get so much joy out of something, you got to write a story about it.
Mm-hmm. Or passion, know? Or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like I like trains, so that's why I put my little murder mystery on the railway.
Right.
Right?
I like ancient history. That's why my exactly. book is set in ancient Greece.
Yeah. Yeah. So it makes stories. The problem these days, I think, is that people, they don't really engage with the written word, right?
Right, with the,
you know, so like as consumers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you engage with the written word, you might get simulated to write yourself,
right?
I think.
Did you know you can borrow an internet hub from the library and take Wi-Fi with you wherever you go? Ask our staff at your local branch for more details. Does writing energize or exhaust you? Or both?
All of the above.
Yeah.
It just depends. Like redrafting, editing, reworking, trying to spot your bad grammar and your bad structure and looking for weaknesses in your story, that's work. So that can be exhausting. And the editing can be exhausting, and I've been doing a lot of that, as I say, re-editing mm-hmm. some of my older manuscripts. I think writing the story can be energizing. Like, you know, once you get the scene in your head, mm-hmm. then you can really get going at it. And sometimes you just write and write and write, and you don't even feel like you're doing it. Other times you know the scene, but you got to work at getting it. So that's a bit more exhausting. Mm-hmm. You got to say, I know what this has got to say, and how am I going to do it? And what? And lots of times you can get yourself bogged down. So I guess that's exhaustion. But if mm-hmm. you get, you know, really get going and it's flowing, mm-hmm. then it's exciting. And lots of times you keep writing and say, well, you know, I shouldn't really have started this at 10 o'clock at night, but what do you know, now it's 12:30 and I, you know, whatever.
Still going,
right?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. So, and of course, one of the things too, when it gets bogged down, mm-hmm. is you can, to avoid getting exhausted, you just say, okay, now what's got to happen here is this. So write that down, not as a story, just say, character A has to do this, and then that it has to end up with this happening. Mark it in bold on your manuscript and carry on. Say, right. Okay, what's happening after that? I know what's happening after that, so I can go with that. Mm-hmm. Later on, you can go back and say, okay, what this bold line here says, I got to work here.
Right.
And so then the way I try to approach it is think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I walk around town,
right, yeah.
right?
Whatever works.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
And then maybe you can sketch out. And then when you get to that point, maybe it really will flow for you now, because it wouldn't flow for you then. And so instead of getting hung up and agonizing for hours or days before you carry on, mm-hmm. skip it. Right. Make a note so you don't forget it, because it's got to be there.
It's got to happen, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, of course, you do get the draft, this flowing thing, and then you go back and you reread it and say, well, there should have been some connection here, or this could have happened. And sometimes it's just, well, this would make it better. Right. So you throw in extra stuff.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And that's why commercial editors and publishers don't like you, because, you put all that stuff in there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then, of course, then you say, okay, now I got to make a publishable manuscript.
Right.
Then you're now really got to look at stuff from a copy editing point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And
periods and quotation marks. And
yeah, yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Quotation marks, modifiers.
Typos.
As I say, a lot of advice is reduce the modifiers. Some people try to say modifiers are bad altogether. Well, don't quite go. There's no rule, so don't go down that route.
Right.
You can't have adverbs and adjectives, but if it is good though, from that, for saying, okay, if I've got an adverb, could I just put a better verb in here?
Mm-hmm.
If I got an adjective, could I put a better noun in here?
Mm-hmm.
Or could I phrase it? Or did I put this phrase behind where it should have been? You know, like sometimes I do that a lot. So,
right.
And you'll find that probably when you read my work, but you'll still see lots of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is the other thing, is a manuscript's never finished.
No.
It could be 80 years old and you're just thinking of dying. Darn, why did I write it that way?
Oh yeah, it's already happening with my book. My book came out and I was reading it. I had a book talk on Monday earlier this week. And I'm reading the scene, and yeah, a couple times.
Well, you know what?
That word shouldn't be there, for
okay,
instance.
But it's valid to go back, fix your... If you think so, go change the manuscript, even if it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
Change the manuscript at that point. If you want to keep the manuscript you got published pristine, put it somewhere in a file,
mm-hmm.
and just say, this is the archive file, right?
Yeah.
But then you say, this is the... We're upfront file for this story.
Right.
And, okay, that... Because I do this all the time. Like, I just did Sherwood Green for Ingram.
Mm-hmm.
And I did quite a bit of tinkering. Throwing out phrases, throwing out whole sentences.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I threw out a whole scenario, but I did that once to End of Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep thinking, and you'll keep learning as a writer, right? You get better.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
honestly.
Yeah.
And so you're better. I'm better now than I was when I wrote that line. That was at the beginning of the book, and I got to the end of the book, and I was a better writer at the end of the book. So now I go back to the beginning.
And you can improve it now.
And but you never get it all. And nothing's worse. You get the physical copy and you're reading it. Oh, look at that typo.
Yeah, I know.
You got to live with it. I really love one of my grade 13 English teacher was really the one that turned me on to try and avoid repetition. But you still do it. Like in prorating aid, will say you started three sentences a row with the word the, or he, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you want to do this? You know. And
points that out for you.
Well, one neat way is to eliminate, take the second sentence, knock off the subject, put in a comma, and
right.
or
yeah.
but, or some conjunction.
Yeah, right? Yeah, to connect it. Yeah.
Yeah. So and you find out it works. And the other thing is that you'll find out it gives you a different sentence variety too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the joke about the long sentences. So I forget who the writer was. It was notorious for writing paragraph long sentences.
Oh, yeah.
And they did it on purpose.
Oh.
You know, but that gets tedious. Mm-hmm. And there's only so many semicolons and conjunctions you can use before the reader starts to drift away, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
But if you can actually make it too staccato, too, like subject, verb, object, bang, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the one thing is, of course, there's times you want to speed the action up. You want to slow it down. You want to speed it up, short, pithy sentences.
Yeah.
Want to slow it down, lengthen them out.
Longer
right?
sentences.
And either make the sentences longer, as you like do in your fight scenes, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or because that slows puts the slow motion effect of the action, right?
Right.
Or if you want to create the horror on Dieppe Beach, you might have a whole bunch of short, spiffy sentences because you've got that frenetic kind of feel. That the soldiers might have been had on that beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to deliberately reproduce that.
Right.
And so, but the thing is, you can get all wound up in that too.
Yeah.
Write it first and then think about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. With the editing process. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you think, well, you know, this could be better sped up or maybe slow this down and think something like prorating aid will tell you, well, you're. Sentence length is this, try adding longer or shorter sentences for more variety.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Well, that's something, okay, I'm going to look for that. So
maybe
you realize, yeah, I put a lot of short stuff in here that I shouldn't have been because it wasn't trying to do that.
It just happened.
So I can put in longer sentences to join sentences together and things like that.
How long on average does it take you to write a book?
Well, there's average and there's, well, it just depends and it comes and goes, right? But I would say if you said average, I would say 2 years to get to the end of the second draft, I would think. And the end of the second draft, honestly, should be that's beta reader time. And you might want to involve beta readers before that, depending on how you work and mm-hmm. who's available. And whether they're going to hammer you into the ground or encourage you, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, the great thing about beta readers is they aren't really editors.
No.
It's not their job to hammer you into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
My one beta reader, you know, they're encouraging if nothing else, even if they lie to you.
Right.
I like the story.
I like
it,
yeah.
My one beta reader tried to talk me into submitting a return to a publisher. And I said, I'm too old to put up with that. And because I've got low self-esteem and ADD,
right.
Rejection slips are going to hurt.
Right.
So I don't need that.
You're not made for that.
If I was 30 years old and wanted to have a career as a writer, yes, you got to put up with it. You got to do it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the thing is, the hardest thing is saying, I didn't do that right.
Yeah.
Or when somebody else says it to you, right?
Right.
Right. Then you got to say, yeah. You think you got the first few chapters, you're kind of, that's your first draft. Lots of times, show them that.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I've done, like my one beta reader, I flashed off both the first, I think 10 chapters of Return and a few chapters of Road Tour when I was working on them.
Mm-hmm.
Get reaction, right?
Yeah.
And so say, well, if it's bad, it's a good time to find out.
Earlier, yes. Yeah,
before you've written the other 20 chapters.
Yeah, because I, in my case, I've done 4 or 5 redrafts, right? I thought it was pretty much done. And then to realize that, no, there's lots, you need to add scenes, you got to redo the ending, you got to redo this.
Yeah.
To learn that later on is a harder blow. Learning it earlier is better.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that if you, like, once you get to 3 or 4 chapters, you should... The reader should be going, feel like they're going somewhere. The story is going somewhere, right? So you can then be critique both on technical things and the story, saying, well, this isn't grabbing me. So then how do you get,
you got to change it.
Yeah, you got to put a hole in the boat. If you're just taking the boat across the river and then board the reader, then you got to have a hole in the boat and you're rowing like crazy to get the other side. Right. Something, right? Some melodrama, something, right?
Something, yeah.
Whatever you need to do.
Yeah. Do you believe in writer's block?
Writer's block. Difficult times. Like right now, for instance, I'm working on this third book in the series, and I've got 2 issues. One is about the story. I've got to try and think through more how the story is going to work out a bit. And the second one is just the whole situation of the world has just got me depressed. So. So that one is worse. Like you can see why people run off and hide in the woods and try not to pay attention to anything.
Oh, yeah.
If they want to create, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so, yeah, I think the block can exist, but it depends... I think on the purpose of your writing. If you're writing to demand, you got some editor, some publisher somewhere on the phone all the time telling you to hurry up and finish because they want to get the book ready for Christmas, that can create a tension that blocks you.
Right?
So that's not good.
No.
But I've never experienced that, of course, because I have no publisher doing that to
me. Nobody's calling you.
No. Yeah. And but you can't, like the story gets, if you lose the story or the story loses you, then it's not really a block, but you got to think of really what are you doing with the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you might have to go back and start try to think right through from the beginning again what to do with. And that can slow you down. So because you aren't typing on the keyboard, you think you're blocked.
Right.
But you're actually working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual physical writing it down, once you know where you're going, it can just... scoot right through in the first draft, right? You can just whack off a chapter in a day or a page or something or whatever. But one of the problems is people pay too much attention to people that say, this is how you should write. And this is another thing with this, especially this site that keeps giving you writing prompts. That's what they try to give you. The other thing is Joe Smith's 10 Rules for Writing. And invariably, it might be Joe, but a lot of these people will say, oh, you should set aside 2 hours a day to write, and you should be trying to write one page or a paragraph or whatever a day, right?
Yep.
And if you can't do it to you, that seems like you're blocked.
Right.
So don't even pay attention to that nonsense. That's how they write.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
And all things being equal, maybe it's a good way. But
everyone works differently, though.
Yeah. So if it works for you, done. But the problem is it can lead to that situation where you think you just aren't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're blocked. And the more nervous we get about something, the harder it is to resolve it.
Right.
But you feel like you're blocked. And that being blocked is different than being lazy.
Yeah, they're two different things.
And the other thing is, too, even the lazy thing. But you're lazy. You're laying back in the chair dozing off, but you're thinking about your plot. But you're working.
Right.
You're not lazy.
No.
It's just, writing is not carpentry or ditch digging or gardening. It's not physical doing something all the time or you aren't doing anything. It's not
just that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, so, again, I think what works. So if somebody thinks they're blocked, physically put everything away, I think. but don't put the story out of your head. Mm-hmm. But go over the story. Reread what you already wrote, even.
Right.
I do that quite a bit because sometimes I'm thinking, well, I might want to go here, but what did I say already? Will this make sound stupid then?
Right.
You know, they had the characters say all this stuff back there, and now I'm going to have them do something else that makes that seem silly.
Mm-hmm.
So then you say, well, you got to remember that. And if you forget it, it's a lot more work when you get to the end of the draft. And then you go back and
you got to get fixed.
Then you say, this didn't fit. It's like my brown horse and my painted horse.
Right.
Right. If I hadn't done anything to get her on a painted horse,
mm-hmm.
the reader would have said, how the heck did she get on the horse?
Exactly.
Right. And because that was a bit of a challenge, not a block, a challenge, it led to a whole scenario that you never even expected.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you don't really experience it then.
Well, as I say, like slow times, I'll go a long time without writing new lines in a story.
Okay, yeah.
But
it's not really a block.
If we look at the average writing, you know, I might then get to the point where I will slam down a whole draft of a chapter.
Right.
So if I average it all out, there was no block in there. It was just the distance between the time I finished writing that chapter and then did this other chapter. Might have been some time,
mm-hmm.
but theoretically we developed the story, right? I mean, right. It's like, this is the problem with writing, right? It's in your head,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The worst part is having to take your time to type it out.
It is, yeah, it is.
Right? That's the worst thing.
That's the worst part, yeah, because it is all in your head.
Yeah, so that's what I like. Sometimes I tell myself stories.
Mm-hmm.
I never write them down because I just say, oh, that's a nice story, but I don't feel like doing the work to write that.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe the most I'll do is put it as a inspirational line in my idea folder.
Right. Yeah. Right? Go in there, yeah.
And but other than that, because it's just, you know, you can't write everything. And you do the same thing with your story. You might say, oh, this should happen. Well, I don't know how you work, but I've got 3 files when I'm drafting a story. I've got the draft.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a notes file, and then I've got a style sheet file. And the style sheet is, among other things, helps you keep spelling the character's name the same way right through the story. That's always a good help.
Oh, yeah. That's right? A good idea, yeah.
Right? And all sorts of other things, like even how you're going to format the thing before you start. Like, this is something I've just learned that I should have been doing before. But you say, okay, I'm going to 6x9 inch margin sizes, full justified, whatever I'm going to do, right?
Right.
Is a good thing to have right at the beginning of your every style sheet, mm-hmm. even if you create a new one for another story.
Right.
So it reminds you, okay, this is how I'm setting it up to start. So then you get a good idea of how long the thing is when you're working on it.
And you don't have to go back and manually do
it.
And
if you change all of the everything from the justification to the margins later, you're going to change the physical length of what you're doing, right? And mm-hmm. you may not want that.
Right.
And so that's one of the things. And then the other stuff is, what's a contraction for number? N-O period is the accepted one. And so maybe if you got to remind yourself, you write that down. Number equals N-O period.
Right.
Right. And numerals are what? Anything below 10, you write it out. And above 10, you use the numerals. That's one rule people use.
Mm-hmm.
Again, rules, you know, if it works, if it looks stupid, don't do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whether the rule says so or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and they have all sorts of things like that. And so mm-hmm. the style sheet's important. The idea sheet, well, you're thinking about something, well, maybe this should happen. So you throw it in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem is sometimes that the idea, the notes can get all jumbled up.
Yeah,
you know, because where do you put this new idea? Where does it fit into this thing? I tend to have the habit of just throwing it at the top of the notes file,
right?
And then try to tell myself again. If you get one of these pauses in your writing,
mm-hmm.
read your notes.
Right.
Maybe you had the idea in there all along, and you forgot that you had that idea.
Right. It's right? Sitting there somewhere though.
Yeah. So yeah. Get it out and say, "Oh yeah, I was going to have them do this, or I was going to have." See, I'm planet building in this story, and so planet building is a tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
Old style science fiction writers had a pretty much a clean slate because they could even planet build Venus and Mars because no one knew anything about them.
Right.
And I just finished writing reading an Andre Norton, an old story of hers. Well, they're all old. She's been dead for a long time. Where she created this planet, right? And I'm reading it thinking, well, this is pretty standard planet creation at the time, mm-hmm. right? You have strange characters, funny names, all sorts of stuff, right? Like, you've got planet building in your story, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
because it's so long ago.
The Forbidden Forest kind of people, right? And the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And so that kind of work. And then you've got to decide which way you're going to go with it. Mm-hmm. Because I don't build that kind of planet. I'm more interested in the ideas of how, say, for instance, you or her introduce that kind of place, mm-hmm. right? Not the details of it. So right. you go through a long expository planet Z, blah, 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 blah.
Exposition,
or you introduce it bits and pieces. I prefer the bits and pieces part myself. The other right. stuff sounds like you're sitting in a lecture and how to write science fiction or something.
And it gets boring quickly.
Yeah. So you have the characters gradually introduce what they look like, what the place is like. You only present it as enough up front so that the reader kind of can get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm wondering how Lewis Carroll did it when Ellis fell down the rabbit hole.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Or did she go through a mirror? Which one did she do?
Alice was through the rabbit hole.
Rabbit hole, yeah.
Yeah.
Through the looking glass was another story.
Mm-hmm.
That he already conceived of the nonsense at the bottom of the rabbit hole.
Right.
I mean, it's a political story. Mm-hmm. It's hugely political. Just like Gulliver's Travels is a political polemic disguised right. as a story, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's but did Carroll conceive of that, or did he just, like, and he built it up, and it was various layers of things happened, right?
Right.
He introduced the various crazy characters and the whole thing and kind of built it up instead of describing the whole thing up front.
Right.
So I got a feeling Carroll just told himself the story and had fun with it.
That
and I think
like...
he knew what he wanted to make fun of,
yeah,
which was British society, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How he did it was quite fun.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of an ideal in how I think and how you kind of do things.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Huron County Author Talk with your host, Hamilton Baker. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Don as much as I did. If you'd like to purchase one of his books, you can order them through his website, dndhayward.ca. That's dandhayward.ca. You can also borrow many of his books from the library. Visit HuronCountyLibrary.ca to place a hold today. Stay tuned for our next episode that will release in 2 weeks. The music on this program is Echo by Alan McKellis. Thanks for listening.